Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the award announced today by the Swedish Academy of the Nobel Prize in Literature that went to Bob Dylan, the 75-year-old singer-songwriter who joins a pantheon of literary giants like T.S. Eliot, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Doris Lessing, Günter Grass, and Samuel Beckett. Sean Wilentz, a professor of history at Princeton University and author of Bob Dylan in America, joins us to discuss this unusual award that has caught the literary world by surprise, as well as the growing evidence of complicity between the Russian government and WikiLeaks, whose latest dump of emails hacked from the private account of John Podesta, the head of Hillary Clinton's campaign, are being seized on by Donald Trump, whose flailing campaign is relying more and more on Russian hacks and Julian Assange's leaks in their attempt to demonize Hillary Clinton by exposing the private conversations of her inner circle that so far reveal infighting amongst her staff that don't amount to much. Then we are joined in the studio by Steve Scroven, the head, a board member of Public Citizen and the host of Stand Up for Main Street, a political comedy benefit for Public Citizen. He wrote for the TV show Seinfeld, Till Death, and Everybody Loves Raymond, and along with Ray Romano, Will Durst will also perform at this benefit with Al Madrigal, Jody Miller, and others. And since Will Durst has been described by the New York Times as possibly the best political comic in the country, we will discuss this year's amazing race for the presidency with Will Durst and try to find the humor in what both sides in this race see as it's either our candidate or the apocalypse. Then finally, we will speak with Kevin Hewison, Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Contemporary Asia and Emeritus Distinguished Professor of Asian Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He joins us to discuss the death at the age of 88 of the King of Thailand, who was the world's longest reigning monarch with 70 years as head of state. We will discuss the reverence for the royal family and laws that forbid anyone from insulting them, as well as the populist political movement that won elections in a landslide, which the Thai military, the conservative establishment, and the monarchy have suppressed following the military's latest coup in 2014. And joining us now is Sean Wilentz, who's the George Henry Davis 1886 Professor of American History at Princeton University, where he has taught since 1979. He's a contributing editor at The New Republic, and his books include The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, The Age of Reagan, A History, 1974 to 2008, and his latest, Bob Dylan in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sean Wilentz. Sean, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, yes. So, Sean, what do you make of the Nobel Prize in Literature to Bob Dylan? It certainly got some of the literary establishment. Perhaps they're a little stodgy. This is a different kind of an award. So, how does it resonate with you?
Oh, I think it's terrific. I think it's wonderful. Look, Bob Dylan is one of the great literary figures of our time, and just because he doesn't write novels, and just because he is a lyric poet and a lyricist, a songwriter, that doesn't make him any less a literary figure, literary genius. I don't know what the fuss is all about. I mean, yes, he's an entertainer, but, you know, Shakespeare is an entertainer, too. I mean, he didn't get published in the book until the first folio or something. I mean, what are we talking about? I don't get it. I think Bob Dylan completely deserves this award. I'm delighted they awarded it to him, and, you know, full speed ahead.
Well, the extent to which the Swedish Academy, which, from judging from the film of these Nobel award ceremonies with the black tie, etc., and some of these ancient characters, that's a pretty stodgy bunch. So they're clearly breaking with tradition.
Right, right. Well, I mean, look, it's not so much breaking with traditions, I think expanding their understanding of what literature is. Now, you know, there is an older-fashioned view, I suppose, which says that literature is what gets read in English departments or something, or what is approved to be literature. But 100, 200 years ago, you know, Robert Burns was a great poet, yet he wasn't, you know, he was writing poetry to be sung to. I mean, look, it's an ancient form, Ian. I mean, you know, Homer sang his poems, his epic poems. The idea that this is somehow that because it's about entertainment rather than about, you know, something, you know, or about entertainment as well as about poetic intention, it strikes me as exceedingly narrow. So I don't see them breaking so much as expanding.
Well, it would seem then that that people have should be feeling pleased, and a generation of people who have been influenced by Bob Dylan. And here, just not far from where I'm speaking to you, Sean Wilentz, they have what they've dubbed the Old Cella Festival at Coachella, where Dylan and the Rolling Stones and The Who, etc., all played. And everybody I've talked to have been there said, these guys may be in their 70, but they're still rocking and rolling.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, of that crew, and it was in a great rock and roll show, I gather, and I heard some of Bob Dylan's work. I showed them the Rolling Stones. There's no one of those people other than Bob Dylan that you consider, you know, coming up for an award like this, right? I mean, rock and roll is rock and roll, and Bob Dylan is certainly rock and roll. However, he's also a literary master. You know, if you take my word for it, take, you know, Christopher Rix's word for it. Any number of very, very eminent critics have understood what Bob Dylan's about. For that matter, so have, you know, many great writers. I mean, I think today I heard that Salman Rushdie, among others, tweeted out congratulations to Dylan. You know, it's in part generational. I mean, the people who came of age in the 1960s and 1970s certainly have an affection for Dylan, which is particularly deep. But I think that, you know, by now it's beyond cavil that Bob Dylan is a major literary figure.
Well, he did write he published in 2004 the widely acclaimed book Chronicles, Volume 1.
That's correct. And I think that that only enlarges our sense of him as an artist. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, and I may be partial about all of this, but I think the Chronicles is one of the great modern American memoirs. American memoir being a great form, and he showed himself more than adept at that.
So, Sean Wilentz again is the George Henry Davis 1988 Professor of in American History at Princeton University, where he's taught since 1979. He's a contributing editor at The New Republic, and his books include The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, The Age of Reagan, A History 1974 to 2009, and his latest book is Bob Dylan in America. So clearly you were ahead of the curve, Sean, in the sense that you wrote about Bob Dylan in a serious book. So tell us why you decided as a historian that Bob Dylan deserved your attention.
Right. Well, I mean, Bob Dylan is a particularly important figure in American culture. I mean, he has placed himself in the very beginning at a particular point in American culture, beginning with the American folk tradition, which is really the Anglo-American folk tradition. He began his serious artistry there. He had a rock and roll background, but that's where he began. And those works, as seen in the Child Ballads and others, were always understood by serious literary critics as literary works as well as pieces of popular culture. And Dylan was right in the middle of all of that. In fact, he said, people once wondered, why is a person so of such literary intelligence as you writing folk songs? Folk songs are so simple. And Dylan responded, I think quite accurately, that there's nothing simple about the old folk tradition, that it's highly literary. I mean, you have stories there of roses and briars growing out of people's hearts and entwining with each other. This is the wildest kind of poetry you can imagine. Well, that was there in the folk tradition. Dylan understood that and made of it a different kind of poetry that was very much his own. But he understood the possibilities of that tradition, more than others did, more than anybody else did. He then advanced to many other levels. He got involved in serious poetry, in surrealist poetry, in Rimbaud, with the Beats for a while, but then moved on, into many other orbits. He has managed in American culture to take shards and bits of American culture, bring them together in ways that had never been imagined before, and create a kind of alchemy. And out of that alchemy, he has created great art, and that's why I think he's particularly important to Americans. So in my book, I try to trace the roots and connections of Dylan's work in deeper aspects of American culture. That's what the book is really about. And that's why I find him so fascinating, because you're going to learn a great deal about Bob Dylan by studying America, but you're going to learn a great deal about America by studying Bob Dylan.
And indeed, great literature is about simplicity, not about florid writing.
Correct.
And so let's turn a little bit, because I wanted to bring this up, because we've spoken before where you were very skeptical of the adoration of Julian Assange and also of Edward Snowden. And I've asked this question of a number of people lately, because I find it absolutely mystifying that the Republican Party, the GOP, one of the great American mm-hmm. political parties, is relying on Russian hacks and Julian Assange to get their guy in the White House. And he looks right. like he's imploding. He's more and more red-faced and wound up, and relying more and more on demonizing Hillary Clinton by exposing the latest data dump from Julian Assange of leaks of the private mm-hmm. conversations of Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, John Podesta. But so right. far, all I've seen from these is that the main criticism is that that Hillary Clinton's campaign is guilty of infighting. But it's pretty right. boring stuff.
No other campaign in history, right?
Right, right, you know? Exactly. But it's the rest
so
of it.
It's so boring.
It's nothing.
I know these people.
Yeah.
I know some of these people. It's boring. Who cares? But
right.
he's going to keep anything alive that he can. The FSB is basically the research arm of the Trump campaign. The campaign is being conducted out of the Trump Tower, but one of its major sources of information, if not its only major source of information, is Moscow, is the Kremlin. And Julian Assange can only be understood as an agent of the Russian government. That is clear. So what is going on here? We are seeing the most extraordinary thing whereby, for example, misreadings. I read one of these very carefully. A misreading of a document that was lifted from the Podesta file. A misreading of it seemed to blame Sidney Blumenthal, a conveniently Jewish name, which is fine for the Russians as well as for some of Trump's supporters, for admitting somehow that the Benghazi disaster could have been averted, and seeming to blame the Clinton administration. It's bizarre. Well, it was a falsified document. It was a document that was lifted from Podesta's files, falsified by the FSB, then put on their outlet called Sputnik, and reported as a great find in the Podesta files. It was a total nonsense. It was a total misreading. It was clear from the start. Yet, that very night, Donald Trump is broadcasting this stuff, is announced, claiming this misinformation on the stump in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. In other words, it's going from FSB to Assange, directly to Sputnik, and then to Donald Trump. This is the connection. It's shocking. It is shocking that a major adversary power can be interfering in an American presidential campaign this way, and that the media is reporting on John Podesta's boring emails rather than about this extraordinary development, which not only is disqualifying, it begins to border on treason.
Well, I believe the Financial Times and also the Washington Post are about to print stories that link the Kremlin, Putin, directly to Donald Trump. And it's been pretty clear to me for some time that there are clear ties and that Donald Trump
right.
refuses in any way to criticize Vladimir Putin, as he did
right.
clearly in the last debate with Hillary Clinton. And there right. are speculations, of course, when he was over there for the 2013 Miss Universe contest, that he was seen with a bunch of young women, that Putin got the honey trap video of him later that night with the girls in the Ritz mm-hmm. Hotel. In the presidential suite. That is, of course, an MO. In fact, Putin got elected in his first election by a landslide. He ran against a prosecutor who Putin caught in a honey trap, which was filmed and then shown on Russian television. And that, of course,
right.
destroyed this guy, and Putin won by a landslide. So
right.
Have you heard anything about that? I know it's in keeping with the kind of scandal-ridden
yeah.
campaign
yeah.
we have now.
Well, I mean, I've heard the same, I think, same things you have about this video and about what's coming. We'll see what's coming in the Post and in the FT. I mean, I think what's going on here, though, the MO that you're talking about, what's consistent about what Putin is doing, is that Putin is interfering in American politics, American presidential politics, in the same way that he's tried to do in Europe as well, trying to back, nationalist, right-wing nationalist parties in a way that's not simply pushing a particular political line, although he's doing that, but in a way that degrades democracy, that makes democracy look like a sham. That is what Putin is out to do. And he's doing it because basically he has his own ideology, which people have not talked about enough, although there was an interesting piece by Timothy Snyder about this in the Times. He's basically a fascist, and that has to be recognized purely and simply. He's a follower of Russian fascist ideologues, and that is what he's pushing. But like fascists, he's not there simply to glorify a particular ideology of his own. He's there to degrade democracy. And you know what? Shockingly, he has succeeded in doing that much, or helped Trump do that to a shocking degree in this election, because this election isn't even an election anymore. It's a national crisis. It's an abscessed thing. It's a diseased thing. It is no longer, despite the fact that there are party labels there, no. They have managed to degrade it thus far. I mean, it's extraordinary to me that we're going through what we're going through, and I hope that that after the election that American democracy can rebound.
Well, it is. I mean, I understand why Putin would, who has taken stolen democracy from his own people, why he would say to his Russian people, and that after all is his main audience, that look, I may have taken democracy away from you, but look at those American hypocrites. Look what kind of democracy they have,
yes.
And that he's doing everything he can to make it dysfunctional and sordid. How do you get the press to stop? Marching to his tune.
Well, I mean, I think we'll wait and see what the FT does and we'll try to get to see what the FT does and what the Washington Post reports. I mean, the media's finally catching on to this fine. I mean, it's been funny, right? They've been reporting this Tinkers to Everest to Chance delivery from Assange, the FSB, Assange, Sputnik to Trump, but then they report on John Podesta's emails. If the media looks at the real story, they'll have a real story. That is a shocker. And we'll see. I mean, if it's happening now, finally, that's great.
Right. Well, but they don't, when they do report these stories, they don't point out that these emails were hacked. That's very different.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, who would want their emails hacked? Seriously.
Precisely. Well, look, when the New York Times gets its emails hacked, as it has been, there's a great hue and cry about it. But now, when it's John Podesta's, it becomes fodder for the journalists to prey upon. Well, you know what? These emails are nowhere near as important as the fact of where they came from, and they came from the Russians hacking John Podesta's email. This was an act of cyber war against the United States. Will the media finally wake up and say that?
Well, just in closing then, Sean Wilentz, back to your book, Bob Dylan in America. Will you, I'm looking forward to seeing him at the ceremony. I hope he goes. And
It's going to be great. Yeah, I mean, you know, him, I mean, you know, the entourage is going to be fantastic. And we'll see what Bob, you know, people are always interested in what Bob Dylan does. I suspect he'll be very grateful and very receptive. He has to give a speech, so we'll see what his speech is. The last time he gave a speech was a speech to the the Music Cares business. It was a great success. So I hope he gives a similar speech in Oslo or in Stockholm or wherever the ceremony is going to be.
Well, indeed. And I thank you for joining us, Sean Wilentz.
Thank you, Ian. I'll see you soon.
Definitely. And again, I've been speaking with Sean Wilentz, who is the George Henry Davis 1886 Professor of American History at Princeton University, where he has taught since 1979. He is a contributing editor at The New Republic, and his books include The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, The Age of Reagan, A History, 1974 to 2008, and his latest book is Bob Dylan in America. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking with the comedian Will Durst and Steve Scroven.
When she said, "Don't waste your words, they're just lies," I cried she was deaf. And she worked on my face until breaking my eyes and saying, "What else you got left?" Yeah, it was then I got up to leave, but she said, "Don't forget."
Oh.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Steve Scroven, who's a board member at Public Citizen and the host of Stand Up for Main Street, a political comedy benefit for public citizens. He wrote for television shows, including Seinfeld, Everybody Loves Raymond, and Till Death, and co-wrote, produced, and directed An Unreasonable Man, the documentary about the life and career of Ralph Nader. And also joining us is Will Durst, a comedian and political satirist who has patched together a comedy quilt in which he weaves together columns, books, radio, and television commentaries, acting, voiceovers, and especially stand-up comedy. Described by the New York Times as possibly the best political comic in the country, his humor columns have appeared in Esquire, the San Francisco Chronicle, National Lampoon, and the New York Times. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Scroven and Will Durst.
Thank you, Ian.
Mr. Masters.
Let me begin with Steve, since he's organized this benefit. You've done these before.
This is number six.
And run through the lineup, because it's pretty impressive.
The lineup is Ray Romano, Al Madrigal from The Daily Show, and I assume everybody knows who Ray is from Everybody Loves Raymond and Men of Certain Age, and was the best thing in the HBO's Vinyl, to my
Yeah, he was, wasn't it? And that
yes.
was an unusual role for him.
Yes. Fred Stoller, who's also an Everywhere Loves Raymond and a Seinfeld alum. Jody Miller, who is on America's Got Talent, very funny comedian. The Jasons, a young musical group. There'll be a little change of pace there. And a duo called the Frangella Duo, which is Eleanor Collier and Francis Eleanor Collier and Francis Shelton, or is it Francis Collier?
Whatever.
I'm sorry, guys. And, of course, the incomparable Will Durst.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, the incomparable Will Durst. You know, I, as a journalist, I really rely on Public Citizen because, you know, citizens don't know what goes on Capitol Hill, all those backroom deals. You don't know about the riders that they put on these bills, these must-pass bills, where they put in incredibly toxic and poisonous riders. And without that kind of information, the public would be completely in the dark. So in my book, they do a heroic job and a very necessary one. Why are you supporting them, Will?
Well, I see that as my responsibility on stage. I don't proselytize. I just try to plant seeds of doubt. You know, the whole journalistic credo of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. And that's to make people laugh at the same time. Hopefully.
Well, if comedy is the sugar on the bitter pill of politics, it's a pretty bitter period, wouldn't you say, that we're going through?
Every 4 years, political comics say, you know, every election cycle is good for comedy, but especially this time.
Well, you couldn't invent Donald Trump. And by the way, I can't resist the political reality as opposed to comedy. I just saw him last night. I haven't seen him today, but he's looking like he's going to explode. He's more and more red-faced, more and more manic. Do you think he's going to last the distance?
That's a good question. He's going to implode before our very eyes. I really expected him to attack Hillary during the debate. I think we're just lucky he didn't throw his own feces at Anderson Cooper.
Well, it's interesting you say he had a red face, Ian, because usually his face is orange. So he's obviously gone from code orange to code red. So there's probably trouble brewing.
He said DEFCON 1.
Yes.
So, but what does it say about the fact that there are still people supporting him? I mean, it's like I often feel I'm in an alternative universe here.
I see it kind of like the Brexit vote, that people, you know, there were quotes after Brexit. People said, oh, I wouldn't have voted for it if I thought it would pass. And I think that's the same thing with Trump.
And Steve, let me just again remind our audience, we're speaking with Steve Scroven, who's a board member at Public Citizen, the host of Stand Up for Main Street, a political comedy benefit for Public Citizen. He wrote for television shows including Seinfeld, Everybody Loves Raymond, and Till Death, and co-wrote, produced, and directed An Unreasonable Man, the documentary about the life and career of Ralph Nader. And also joining us is Will Durst, a comedian and political satirist who has patched together a comedy quilt in which he weaves together columns, books, radio, and television commentaries, acting, voice conservatives, and especially stand-up comedy. Described by the New York Times as possibly the best political comic in the country, his humor columns have appeared in Esquire, the San Francisco Chronicle, National Lampoon, and the New York Times. So, well, when do we weep and when do we laugh, though? I mean, it's such a scary prospect. As I mentioned, there are still people that support this guy. I don't think, if it wasn't for Donald Trump running against Hillary Clinton, I don't think she'd be in very good shape. Even these hacked emails, by the way, one of her aides says even that clown from Texas,
Ted Cruz,
could beat her. So what's happened to our polity?
I think we become so polarized, and it's just hard. He looks like somebody different, and that's what people want right now. But it's hard sometimes making fun of him, because how do you parody a parody? It's like trying to staple smoke.
Well, it does seem that we laugh a lot at him, but the joke could well be on us, and that's what I find.
I have a thought about that, Ian, and I think what we don't focus on is the conditions that created a Donald Trump. And I think people like us, and I'll just say me, consider themselves liberals, usually vote Democratic, we have to kind of look in the mirror and say, what have we not done? What have we done to enable this to happen, these economic conditions? Because obviously people are in pain, and when they're in pain, a certain percentage of them can turn to an authoritarian figure like a Donald Trump, who's kind of a classic fascist, although he doesn't really have a coherent ideology. And I think we need to say, okay, what are we doing, or what are we not doing that sowed the ground for this?
Well, lately the term Vichy Republicans was coined by James Fellows at the Atlantic, and it does apply to the kind of agony that these Republicans are in, which I don't think is sufficient. They should be in Dante's seventh level of hell, I think, for what they're doing or what they're failing to do in terms of showing some moral fiber. But it's an astounding situation to think that the Republican Party is relying on Vladimir Putin and Julian Assange to get their guy in the White House. What has the world come to?
By the way, I tried to book them for the show, too, Stand Up for Main Street. But apparently Julian is – he can't get out. He was tied up.
No, he can't make the flight by Sunday. I found, though, that being on stage – and obviously, when we do stand-up comedy, I mean, you can do comedy in the reddest of states, and the people who come to the theater will be the bluest of those people in that red state. So maybe we're in a bubble, but I have found that laughing is cathartic. It's almost a release. People come up to me afterwards and say, oh, my God, thank you so much. I never thought I'd laugh again.
So you mean there are little islands of blue folks in these red states? It's not monolithically mega churches and Fox News?
It's like Austin, Texas.
The Molly Ivins called Austin, Texas, the blueberry in the bowl of tomato soup.
Is there a way, though, that you can expand from these little islands of blue in the sea of red?
I think comedy is universal. I think everybody, you know, and it's an apocryphal story, but supposedly Lincoln was telling a joke at a soiree at the White House during the Civil War, and some madam came up to him and said, I find that the bad behavior at this point. And he turned to her and he said, "Madam, we laugh in order not to cry." So I think the comedians, we are the canaries in the coal mine.
And we're gonna be chirping on Sunday, October 16th at the Writers Guild Theater. I'm glad you like that one, Will. At North 135 North Doheny, which is off Wilshire. It's a beautiful theater, 475 seat theater. This is the sixth year in a row we've done it, and it's called Stand Up for Main Street. And it is just an evening of laughter and inspiration. I can say that without sounding without irony, because it really is mostly laughter. And then Rob Weissman, our president, gets up and kind of gives us the state of the world. And one of the reasons I've been supporting Public Citizen is for this very thing. You can give money to a politician, which is fine, and I've done that. And that'll probably go a lot to paying off his political consultants. But when you give to Public Citizen, you're giving – it's like they're like the people's lobbyists. You know that they're going to do absolutely the right thing with that. And it's not going for a fancy building or television ads. So that's what we've got going at the Writers Guild Theater. It's called Stand Up for Main Street. I'm going to host with my friend Lou Schneider, who is a writer friend of mine on Everybody Loves Raymond. We're going to have Ray Romano, Al Madrigal, the Frangela Duo, Fred Stoller, Jody Miller, the Jasons, and the incomparable Will Durst.
Yeah, this is an incredible lineup.
And the incomparable Will Durst, you mentioned Abe Lincoln. That actually came up in the debate where Donald Trump tried to nail Hillary Clinton from these hacked emails. And it turned out that she was actually talking about Abraham Lincoln from that Spielberg movie. But did it work?
By the way, Ian, we also did try to book Abraham Lincoln, but apparently he's very phobic. He's very phobic about theaters.
So what did you think of how sort of the guy that this conservative talk show host in Wisconsin calls the Orange Duce was strutting around the stage? I mean, if you turned the volume off, it would have looked pretty bizarre, wouldn't it? This sort of short lady and this tall guy. In fact, one of the funniest things I heard afterwards was, remember when Trump was asked right in front of this lady, this Muslim lady, who asked a question about Islamophobia, and then Donald Trump answered the question by giving an Islamophobic answer. And
at least it was relevant to the question, which usually didn't happen.
But
he started out the debate claiming that he grabs women by the private parts because of ISIS.
Yes. That's in comedian's term, we'll understand that. That's what you call a hard segue.
Right. Well, you know what? You know, there's a movie coming out starring Paul Ryan. It's called Saving Ryan's Privates.
I think I've seen that online.
But after that debate, though, when Trump made that remark that the Muslims have to report crimes, there was a Muslim comedian, I think he tweeted or something to MSNBC, but anyway, Brian Williams read it, and it was, "I'm a Muslim reporting a crime. A madman is attacking a woman in Missouri."
In St. Louis.
St. Louis, right. So what's going on?
Well, I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu said that his Muslim stance was too extreme. And I don't know nothing, but when you get called Islamophobic by the Israelis, that's not good.
So what's going on, though, with this weird, creepy clown fixation? Is it some kind of manifestation of all of this political paranoia that's out there?
Yes, you're talking about the clown faces with Trump.
Well, no, there's all these reports
about... No, there's
about
a meme out there.
Yeah.
Creepy clowns are appearing all over America. I think it's just people responding to the Trump signs.
But have you heard about this? But they're personally in the woods lurking everywhere.
I've been in the Ecuadorian embassy with Julian Assange, so I'm really kind of out of touch.
So is this this is just made up, do you think? Or just a manifestation of the paranoid nature of American politics?
Is Richard?
I think you're right. Yeah, right.
Yeah. I think it's.
So you haven't had a clown sighting, either of you guys, right?
No.
I see.
And we're in comedy.
That's right. Yeah. You know, Trump is kind of like this virus that has been allowed to bubble up, and fortunately, in this country, we still have enough antibodies to suppress him. Whereas, you know, in places like Europe, they actually can get seats in Parliament. The right wing nationalists. This I haven't seen anything like this since George Wallace, and George Wallace was merely a third-party candidate. So this is kind of a scary thing. So I'm not surprised clowns are running around.
So what are we going to do then in terms of if there's a post-election revolution? Because Trump has covered his bets by saying that if he wins, it'll be great again. He'll make America great again and build a wall. But if he loses, it's rigged. and it looks like he might lose, and you'll have a lot of angry gun-toting folks out there. Do you think the country's heading towards an OK Corral political situation?
Well, I think Donald Trump provided the answer himself the other day when he said, be sure to vote on November 28th.
Yeah,
so right. Hopefully his supporters will take him by his word.
And he's only got himself to blame to go giving out the wrong date. Here's what I understand about Trump, Ian. He's bankrupted casinos. How do you go bankrupt owning a casino? I mean, this is a place where people go for the express purpose of just handing you their money.
Right.
And a certain percentage of them actually have a disease that compels them to hand you their money.
Right.
And there's an expression called the house always wins.
Exactly.
How do you go belly up on that? What kind of a businessman is that?
Right. How did this winner lose that one? Do you have any thoughts on that, Will?
Well, yeah, I mean, he's declared bankruptcy six times, and three of them were for casinos. I mean, how bad of a businessman do you have to be to actually break a perpetual money machine three times?
Well, you know, the groping thing is obviously there are all kinds of gropees, I guess. So what would you call victims of his groping? They're coming out of the woodwork. And
gropees, I like that.
It's likely to continue for some time. And we may be in a kind of situation like the Bill Cosby, you know, even though Trump is actually accused, saying that he's going to turn the Bill Clinton's peccadilloes into a Bill Cosby situation. But at this point, though, the other shoe that's going to drop, and it's supposed to drop today, and I'm waiting to hear from the Financial Times, and both the Financial Times and the Washington Post apparently have stories on linking Putin directly to Trump. If that shoe drops, what do you think? I mean, do you think that, because as I was saying earlier, it's astounding to see the Republican Party depending upon Putin and Assange to get their guy elected. And this one, I think, will be a bigger political bombshell than even the women. What's your thoughts?
Well, no matter how low you think the election has gone, Trump manages to dig another sub-basement. I think he's actually trying to attack China from below.
Yeah, I think he's already cooked, and that will probably put the nail in the coffin. Although I think people on an emotional level identify more with the groping thing. The businesses with Putin is a little too abstract, but the sexual assault is a really emotional thing. So that was probably the big blow. And I just wonder what it's going to do to his brand, because that's really what he cares about is his brand.
Yeah, well, that was one of the suspicions all along, that his political run was basically to improve his brand as opposed to seriously become president. At one point when he got the nomination and he's walking through the gold-plated pink marble of Trump Tower, it looked like that scene in the movie The Candidate with Robert Redford. Like, what do I do now?
Yeah.
So, Will Durst, do you think, though, that, again, in terms of this nervousness that people still have about the even possibility that Donald Trump could be president, and one of the things that I think why it's still a remote possibility is that he's tapping into this kind of Kardashian culture. Here we are trying to sell a book, which is old school. You know, that's the dead tree business, as they call it. And yet this guy has such a facility. And there's so many people that are in cyberspace where so much is said by so many about so little. And they're in this whole world of Instagram where people are living vicariously off the tawdry activities of some celebrity and fixated on what Kim Kardashian has for breakfast, et cetera. So do you see a cultural divide there that gives Trump a certain advantage in this new Kardashian culture?
Well, Ian, I'm a third-generation factory rat from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and my grandpa, my dad, my stepmom, my mom, myself, we all worked at a tractor factory called Alice Chalmers. And back then, when I was growing up, my dad had, you know, he was the breadwinner. And he bought a house, and we would take vacations in the summer and on one salary, and you can't do that today. And I think people misunderstand how society has changed. her work has changed, and they want that back. Of course they can't have it back. You know, Barbara Billingsley is dead. You can't go back to Leave It to Beaver anymore. And it's sometimes you can even understand his appeal to people, because everybody at one point agrees with him because he adopts positions on both sides of every issue, sometimes in the same interview. So it's hard to pin him down.
Well, he's also the arsonist and the fire brigade, because he says that the country's going to hell, which is total nonsense, and it's worse off than ever. And for some reason or other, he suddenly got this compassion for African Americans in their communities, which he said they're living in hell. And then on the one hand, he creates this incredibly apocalyptic picture. And then he says, and by the way, I'm the guy that's going to ride in on a white horse and solve all your problems.
And white is the key word there, because his slogan, Make America Great Again, you just need to substitute the word great with white. And that's really what he's talking about.
Right.
Make America white again.
Right. Well, in the book of Revelation, it says, behold a pale horse.
Nothing about an orange horse.
Yeah, there you go. White, orange, these are the operative colors.
Right. And the rider, his name is Death. Yes. So, that's a pretty apocalyptic ending here. Well, I know you've got work to do there in San Francisco. Any last parting thoughts or an exhortation, perhaps?
No, just the people have to get out and vote. And I know there's a lot of reasons not to vote, but remember, if you don't vote, you can't bitch. So,
well, you're going to vote a lot of times, right?
Well, I'll pick up the slack. Okay.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
See you Sunday, Will.
See you, Stephen.
And Steve, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ian, very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Steve Scroven, who's a board member at Public Citizen, the host of Stand Up for Main Street, a political comedy benefit for Public Citizen. He wrote for television shows including Seinfeld, Everybody Loves Raymond, and Till Death, and co-wrote, produced, and directed An Unreasonable Man, the documentary about the life and career of Ralph Nader. And also joining us was Will Durst, a comedian and political satirist who has patched together a comedy quilt in which he weaves together columns, books, radio and television commentaries, acting, voiceovers, and especially stand-up comedy. Described by the New York Times as possibly the best political comic in the country, his humor's columns have appeared in Esquire, the San Francisco Chronicle, National Lampoon, and the New York Times. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Kevin Hewison, who's an editor-in-chief of the Journal of Contemporary Asia and the Weldon E. Thornton Emeritus Distinguished Professor of Asian Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He joins us from Perth, Australia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kevin Hewison.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks. And Thailand's king is the world's longest reigning monarch, has died after 70 years as head of state. It wasn't a surprise. He's been ill for some time. So let me begin by actually asking you to pronounce his name. It's a bit of a tongue twister.
Bhumibol Adulyadej.
Bhumibol Adulyadej. And
yeah.
Why is Bhumibol Adulyadej so revered, and the royal family in general, in Thailand, which is a country that has very, very polarized politics between the red shirts and the yellow shirts, and then on top of that, you've got yet another military coup, and now the country's run by the military, which happens frequently in its recent history.
Well, I think the first thing to say is the point that you made. He was on the throne for 70 years when he died. So this means that he's the only king that most Thais have ever known. And in that sense, he's been around for everybody's whole life. The monarchy has promoted itself during that period. Actually, when he came to power or came to the throne, the monarchy was in a very weak position, and he was only 18 years old. His brother had just been killed, still in an unexplained incident within the palace, and he had never expected to come to the throne. But during the period since then, through anti-communism, through tremendous economic development, the king has always been around, and the palace media machine and the state's media machine, through much of the period of his early life, there was a military regime in place, promoted the king and the royal family as an institution that provided the country with stability through all of its challenges. And to a very large extent, this is what most Thais know about the king. This is what they're taught in school. This is what they see in the media. Hence, having been around a long time, been on television, in the media, in school books, in cinemas for this whole period, the Thai king has been revered by his people.
So he's been around, obviously, for 70 years as head of state, and he was 88 years old. So let's go back to World War II, when he would have been quite young. But my memory of history was, and you're in Australia, which of course was right in the path of the Japanese Imperial Army and Navy. The Thais sort of invited the Japanese in. What exactly happened there?
Well, of course, the king who just passed away was not in Thailand at the time. He was born in the United States, but grew up mostly in Switzerland. And in Thailand, there was a military regime in place in the 1930s and 40s, which, as Japanese expansionism took place, the Japanese were not really invited in. There was a very short period of fighting, which took place around about the same time as the bombing of Pearl Harbor. But the Thai military leader at the time, who was drawn to the Japanese model, quickly realized that there was no point in fighting the Japanese, and they became allies of the Japanese during World War II.
And then when did the royal family reassert itself? You say that they were quite weak before he took to the throne.
Yes, the military, together with civilians, in 1932 had overthrown the absolute monarchy. Until then, the king was in power without a parliament, etc. They established a parliamentary regime, but the military generally came out on top. The king who was overthrown in 1932 abdicated in the mid-1930s. From memory, I think it was about 1936. And Bhumibol's brother became king. Now, that had been unexpected. His father hadn't been particularly in direct line for coming to the monarchy, and had died relatively young. And the young king came back to Thailand several times to visit, and in 1946 mysteriously was shot and killed in the palace, which then brought Bhumibol to the throne.
And what would explain, would the fact that the military have usurped power so often, would that explain the reverence for the royal family as some sort of alternative to the kind of governance that they've had?
No. The monarchy under the recently passed away king worked in a kind of strategic alliance with the military. The great period of growth for the monarchy, both in economic terms — the current monarchy is said to be the wealthiest monarchy in the world — but also in political terms, where the young king became involved in politics and was able to become involved in politics, came in the late 1950s and early 1960s under a military dictator who was kind of a father figure for the king. Following that, there was another long period of over a decade of military rule in which the king and the military coordinated together, particularly in the war against the Communist Party of Thailand, which was active at the time. And it's really only since the 1970s, as the king matured and as Thailand's politics changed away from a military regime and then back to it, a kind of a flip-flopping throughout much of the period of his later reign, they've worked in concert, essentially. The king, after all, is, and as most monarchs is, have been, is quite conservative. And often parliamentary politics is seen as turbulent and a military regime as providing stability. And the king has always expressed his desire for order and stability in Thailand.
And I take it that in the most recent battle between the so-called yellow shirts and the red shirts, he decided against Thaksin and his sister, did he not? It's pretty hard to follow, but is that the latest reading on before this military coup took place in 2014?
Yes, that's essentially right. I mean, there was an earlier coup in 2006 which overthrew Thaksin. And one of the things that happened in that coup is that Thaksin was considered, particularly amongst elite circles in Thailand, to be unpopular. And yet he, in terms of elections, was probably the most popular prime minister Thailand has ever had. And yet the coup against him in 2006 was considered by people within the elite as popular, as something that the nation wanted. And the king came out very quickly in support of that coup, meeting the generals involved on the very night of the coup to basically assent to the change of government. And that did quite a lot of damage to the monarchy. Now, of course, he became ill soon after that. But we've seen something of a decline in the monarchy since then, both in terms of its political influence and hence the 2014 coup, but also in terms of its popularity. There's been a much more divided opinion over the monarchy and its role in politics in Thailand since then. But of course, there are strong laws in Thailand, the lèse-majesté law, which prevents people speaking out. And dozens of people have been jailed for being critical of the monarchy in recent years. By 2014, when the coup comes along, the king is essentially not doing very much. He's in hospital. He's very ill. And it's the military now which holds the keys to power in Thailand.
But Thaksin, who was deposed and is in exile, and his sister took over, he's an interesting character. You mentioned that he had a lot of popular support. He was a very wealthy man, a kind of, I guess, Thailand's equivalent of Rupert Murdoch, wasn't he, and controlled a lot of the media. But at the same time, he had a popular support, and that clearly went against the establishment and the royal family and the military. So explain that strain, and where will that strain be? Surely it's festering under the surface.
Yes, it certainly is. The great political conflict in Thailand since the early 2000s has essentially been between Thaksin supporters and something that people refer to as the old elite, which sort of circulates around the monarchy and the military. Thaksin, not really a media tycoon, but a telecoms tycoon. He became wealthy, but he came from a provincial family, which was reasonably well off. He came up through the police. He married a police general's daughter, so that he was kind of in the establishment, but because he was from provincial areas, never quite fully in. He formed a political party in 1998, which con- contested the 2001 elections and won with a huge majority, mainly by offering what many journalists refer to as populist policies for the electorate, but were really social welfare items such as universal health care, loans for village-based entrepreneurs and so on. And that made him exceptionally popular, particularly in the poorer areas of Thailand, such as the north and the northeast. And that's where most of his support came from. After 4 years in power as prime minister, elected prime minister, there was another election which produced the biggest landslide ever in Thailand's electoral history, putting Thaksin back in power. And yet it was only about a year later that he was overthrown by the military. So this idea that representation, being elected by the people, has been overthrown again by the military twice in 2006 and 2014, underlies the basic political conflict in Thailand. People who support Thaksin want to be able to elect their leaders. The military and the monarchy, to a large extent, are not so confident that elections produce the best results.
For them.
Yes.
Just in the last minute then, Kevin Hewison, tell us about the Crown Prince who's succeeding the late King.
Well, oddly, it's not exactly clear if he is succeeding the King. The news overnight is that while the Prime Minister, General Prayut Chan-o-cha, announced to the nation that the heir apparent, the Crown Prince Vajiralongkorn, would take over as Rama the Tenth, the next King of Thailand, the Prince has asked for time to grieve for his father before he becomes King. Now, this is a very, very unusual situation. No one really expected this, so we have to wait and see how this is all going to play out. That said, the Crown Prince doesn't have the popularity that his father had. He's a much more remote figure. For much of the last decade or so, he's spent time mainly overseas, particularly in Germany, where he maintains a household. And he's not particularly beloved or widely across Thailand. Now, as a new king, he will inherit, if he does become king, he'll inherit some of the respect that goes with the institution of the monarchy. But it remains to be seen whether, as a 64-year-old, he can now sort of build his reputation in the same way that the king did. Most people don't think that he's able to do that.
Well, I thank you very much. I appreciate of this brief history lesson that we've gotten from you, Kevin Hewison.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Kevin Hewison, who's an editor-in-chief of the Journal of Contemporary Asia and the Weldon E. Thornton Emeritus Distinguished Professor of Asian Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He joined us from Perth, Australia. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. We'll